Bibles open there to Matthew chapter 25. That's where we'll be studying from this morning. Certainly good to see you this morning. I want to again express my appreciation for the opportunity to be with this church this weekend. It's been good to be with you again. And for those whom I've met for the first time, good to meet with you and good to have you with us and good to be part of this fellowship this weekend. Matthew chapter 25, we're kind of straying from the pattern we've been dealing with. And that beginning the last year of Christ, we're well into that phase now. Matthew chapter 25 obviously follows the events of chapter 24, but the events of chapter 24, and I won't be dogmatic about this. If someone disagrees with me about this, I'm not going to fall out with you about it, because I realize that well-thought people disagree with my conclusion about this. But I think Matthew chapter 24 is a single thought. I don't think there's a break in chapter 24 where you have in the first 35 verses the discussion about the destruction of Jerusalem, then beginning in verse 36, the second coming of the Lord. In fact, if you back up to the first part of chapter 24, you have the setting of this whole thing. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and His disciples came up to Him to show Him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now as He sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to Him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of Your coming and of the end of the age?" That second part there in Matthew chapter 24, I think, leads people to the conclusion that there's a two-part discussion here about the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the age, the second coming of the Lord. But in Mark chapter 13, Mark helps, I think, clarify what is really going on here. And notice what he says in verse 5, a repeat of what we just read, but he phrases it a little bit different. "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" So what you have is a single question with kind of an A and a B part. You're talking about the destruction of the temple, and you're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. When will these things be, and when will they be fulfilled? So when we come to Matthew chapter 25, as is characteristic with the teaching of Jesus, He'll lay down a truth. And then to help that truth be visual to these people, He'll come and He'll lay a parable right beside that. And say, let me give you an illustration of something you can understand that will help kind of make what I just said come alive for you. So if my assessment of Matthew chapter 24 is correct, even if you believe the second coming is in there in the last part, it doesn't change what the overall message of chapter 25 is. What the Lord then is trying to get His disciples to see is a single point. So He says then in verse 20, chapter 25, verse 1, and I pointed this out Friday, it begins with a key word, "then." And that follows in view of what I've been saying about the coming destruction and the coming of the Son of Man representatively. Not the coming of the Son of Man physically, literally, but the coming of the Son of Man representatively in the force of the Roman armies, Titus leading them. In view of that, then He says, "The kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom." Then, the kingdom of heaven shall be like. Let me illustrate to you what is really the important thing and what I want you to see, He says, out of everything I've been telling you in chapter 24 is, here's the point. You watch and you be prepared. Don't be found unprepared. Why? Because the kingdom of heaven is like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. There are three simple things that unfold in this story that I want us to look at and then draw some conclusions from them in the end. The first part that we have to see in this story is the place of the wedding. And the place of the wedding is a little bit different than what we experience in our culture. In our culture, boy meets girl. Boy asks girl, in most instances, boy asks girl, "Will you marry me?" having first asked the father of the girl, "Can I marry her?" In our culture, we have boy meets girl. But in their culture, there were three parts to the wedding that were really important. And the first part was, the wedding was arranged. It was arranged by the fathers. And what the fathers would do is they would get together and they would sign a contract. It was called a betrothal. They would sign a contract where this boy and this girl would marry. And then the boy and the girl come together to meet each other. The betrothal was a binding contract. That's why you have in Matthew chapter 1, when Joseph learns that Mary is with child, the language says, he sought to put her away privately. That expression, put away, is the word we use for divorce. Now, they're not married. But marriage there is used to look to the future, as though it had already happened. Sometimes marriage is used to look at the past. Sometimes the term marriage is used to look at the present. But here, because of the betrothal, they were not in fact married, but they were considered by contract to be in the future already married, and to therefore breach that contract was to be considered a divorce. After the betrothal took place, there would be a space of a year in which the young man would then go, and this is the second part, the young man would then go and get the house or the property ready. And he would spend a year doing that and preparing that place then to bring his bride back to. And one of the conditions of the betrothal was he didn't want to make that agreement and spend all of his time preparing to bring his bride home, so in the end, her come up and say, "Oh, I changed my mind." And the third part of that would then be that the bridegroom would go with his party to the house of the bride to bring the bride back to the bridegroom's house. And this was a big social event. This was kind of the event of the village for the year. And there would be a time of gaiety and partying and revelry that would take place that evening. And hopefully somewhere around midnight, the people would depart. But this procession of the bride to the bridegroom's house was a significant part of what was taking place in this marriage ceremony. And everybody from the village would be turning out. Now, in our culture, like I said, what we have is boy meets girl. And if the boy is respectable at all of the place of the girl, knowing that before marriage she is not his, then he will ask the father, "Can I have your daughter's hand in marriage?" When my daughter was dating my future son-in-law, I told my wife, I said, "You tell Cam that Chris has to come ask me." Well, it made him mad, but it didn't make him mad because I said for him to do it. It made him mad because I jumped the gun on him. He already had planned to do that. Now, I did that, number one, because I was being honored. I just admit up front. But that's a father's prerogative. A father has the prerogative to be honored because this is his daughter. And what he's doing is he's establishing his turf. And he's saying, "She's mine, not yours now." And the second thing was, I want him to understand that when I gave her to him, now she's yours, not mine. And I must tell you, in the past many years they've been married, that's coming awfully handy at times. Because he looks at me and I said, "Look, you asked." She said, "Yes, she's yours, not mine." But in that engagement period of time, had there been a breaking off of that, the worst that would have come, if it happened later in the engagement, was after the shower had been given for the parties, you have to give the gifts back. Or you're out of money for the invitations. But it's considered no breach of contract. In fact, there used to be on the law books a law that was against the breach of contract. And that's because when the betrothal was made, it was considered that binding. So what you have taking place here is that kind of scenario. You have the wedding that is established here. The second part that we look at, and the second point we want to consider here then, are the bridesmaids. And let's read. Now there are five of them. Five were wise and five were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. So you have 10 of these bridesmaids. And the idea here is they took their lamps. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16, it talks about, don't hide your lamp under a bushel. Well, that would be like a little candle, we would consider. Here, lamps would be a stick with rags tied on the end of it that would have been dipped in oil, that when you light them, they let off great light. It would have been much more akin to a torch, is the idea. Now here it is at night, and here these bridesmaids are going to light their torches, and you can imagine there's 10 of them to light the way. And here's this procession that comes. But the torches were significant to the bridesmaids. For example, in a wedding today, you have the bride, and you have the best bride, and then you have the bridesmaids that trail after. Well, the bride, in most cases, is adorned in all of her glory in white, and then the best bride, and then the rest of the maids, they have a particular kind of dress that are the colors of the bride. And what those bridesmaids are wearing with their colors are colors that represent the fact, I belong in this party. This is the sign, I belong. And the fact they had their torches was indicative of the fact that they belonged in that place. They had been invited to be part of that arrangement, and they belonged there. But notice the text says they went out to meet. That word meet is not simply to go out and shake hands to greet. That word, they went out to meet the bridegroom, that word meet means they went out to bow before him as though one were royals. So here comes the bride and the bridesmaids, and they go out to meet the bridegroom. And when they meet the bridegroom, they bow before him, paying homage to him. Now, where I want to go with this, I have to tell you, I recognize I need to be careful about this. Because when you examine a parable, not everything in the parable is to mean something. Sometimes something is just in the parable just to mention it. And there's not to be a thing made out of it, so you have to be careful about that. And then sometimes there are things in parables that do have a place and do have meaning, and you try to draw the meaning out of those things. So it's all together. There are two things I'm going to pull out of this parable that just may be part of the scenery. They may not be points at all, but I want you to recognize, I acknowledge that's a possibility. But we ask the question then, who are the bridesmaids? It could just be that bridesmaids are just part players here. And they're part of what this ceremony is. It's hard to have this kind of ceremony without having bridesmaids. And so they're just there, and they're just to be a passing part of the decoration of what the parable is. But it could also be that there's something significant about the bridesmaids. And we ask the question then is there, and if so, who are these bridesmaids? Well, these bridesmaids seem to me to be those who would be people who profess to be believers. People who would profess to be followers. People who would profess to be Christians. They have all the outward signs, all the externals of a commitment. They have the commitment to be there. They have the commitment to participate. They seem to have the commitment to fulfill what they've been invited to do. So they have a commitment that is there. And so here are those who have their sign, the torch. They belong to the party. And they've accepted the the external commitment, the external responsibility to be part of what is involved in this wedding ceremony. I'll put a peg there because that will become important just a little bit later on. There's something else that's said about these five and five. It says five were wise and five were foolish. That word for wise there, that word wise simply means they were thoughtful, they were considerate, they were circumspect. They gave much forethought to what was taking place. The word foolish there, when you define that word, and I use this word advisedly because I don't want any kids to get in trouble with this, but it's the word that describes what's going on here. These five foolish are stupid. They are moronic. That's that word. They are senseless. That's what that word stupid means. They are senseless. They give no thought. They give no sense. They have no sense about what's taking place here. Now the interesting thing is on the surface here, you see the five wise and the five foolish. The narrative tells us there are five wise and five foolish. But had the narrative not mentioned that, you simply had 10 bridesmaids, and on the surface, they had all the externals, and they looked like they all belonged, and you would not have been able to distinguish between the five and the five. But the Lord knows. And so here you have these bridesmaids that come out. Their torches are to be lit. And they are to bow as they meet the bridegroom before him as though one were royal. And it would appear, it would seem that all recognize their place in this party, in this occasion. And that therefore all should be prepared and all should be watchful of what is going on. But the text says, while the bridegroom was delayed, verse 5, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight a cry was heard. Behold, the bridegroom is coming out. Go out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamp. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. And here's the second thing I want to be advised about, that I'm pulling out of this story. And it could just be that this oil that is mentioned here is just kind of a bit player here. It's just a part of what the narrative is. If you're going to have lamps, they've got to be lit, and you've got to have some substance by which they are to be lit, so they're dipped in oil. And that's all it could possibly be. Here you have the bridesmaids, they have their lamps, they're dipped in oil, and some don't have enough oil. Or it could be that here you have these bridesmaids who have their part, as I have defined, and now we come and we ask, what is the oil? What does the oil mean here? Well, in the parable, where you have a wedding feast, the man who provides the wedding feast also provides the garments. And when there are those in the wedding feast who don't have the garments on that have been provided, what happens to them? They're put out of the wedding feast. And it seems to me that the oil here is in the same place of those who don't have the wedding garments. Those who had their wedding garments were those who had accepted the invitation. Those who were the recipients of grace, those who had their salvation, those who had the garments of righteousness on, and therefore they were part of what the wedding feast was. But those who did not have their garments had not prepared themselves. They did not have grace. They did not have salvation. They did not have the garments of righteousness on, and they were put out. And here you have those with oil. They had accepted the invitation, but they had not partaken of the grace, had no salvation, and it made no the invitation had made no difference in the life. They had not been transformed at all. So they had no oil. And so they say, the five foolish or the five wise, give us your oil. The five wise say, no, wait a minute, we've got just enough for ourselves, and if we give it to you, we'll not have enough. Now, as parents with little children, what do we teach our children? What you need to do is you need to learn to share. You need to learn, don't be selfish. So it would seem like, on its surface here, if we read this, that you've got the five wise who have some oil, and the five foolish don't have oil, And therefore they ask, and the five wise say, no, we won't have enough, that therefore the five wise are being selfish. But that's not what the point of the narrative is. The point of the parable is, listen, we prepared, you didn't prepare, and while there was time of preparation, there was oil enough available, and you didn't take advantage of the time when it was available. We did, and we prepared enough for ourselves. We did not prepare enough for you. Oil was available, and you didn't take advantage of the opportunity when it was there. There's something else that enters into this story that's intriguing. The bridegroom waits until it's midnight to come. Well, for most people, not all people, but for most people, what are you doing at midnight? For most people, you're asleep. That's not wrong. It's not wrong to be asleep at midnight. So the time for this bridegroom coming was delayed, and what happened to the bridesmaid? They fell asleep. They're not condemned for sleeping. That's what most people do. Listen, the Lord is not expecting us to live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our rooftop in our pajamas watching for Him to come. Sleep was right and sleep was wholesome. The problem was not that they were asleep. But here you have these five foolish who are like Paul describes in 1 Timothy. They simply seem to have a form of godliness. Now there's something else about this. I don't want to get too mathematical here to say that, okay, when you break people down, they're going to be, if you have this side, this half is going to be accepted because they're going to have the oil. This half, you're not going to be accepted. And so what you do, you take a congregation, add up the numbers, and half of that congregation is going to be saved and half that congregation is going to be lost. The Lord's not playing math here. What the Lord is saying, however, is that in any assembly of people, there will be those who, on a prima facie kind of consideration, will seem to have all the outward appearances of seeming commitment and apparent commitment and apparent acceptance to the invitation, but there will be those who are unprepared in that number. He's not giving the numbers. What He's saying is there are going to be those who, just like in the days of Noah, look back in Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. But on that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but My Father only. But as in the days of Noah, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in the days of Noah, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came, and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now, is there any problem? Is there something wrong with marrying and giving in marriage? Is there something wrong with when you have a marriage with having a rehearsal dinner? Notice I didn't say having a rehearsal. Is there anything wrong with having a rehearsal dinner? No. Is there anything wrong with after the marriage, depending on the depth of pockets of the father, to provide whatever the bride's mother and the bride want the father to go out of his pockets? No. All that's fine to do. That takes places. But what happens is we get wrapped up in the events. We get wrapped up in the events that are going on every day. Here are daily things that take place. And we get wrapped into the events that everything is taking place, and we fail to watch. We fail to prepare. And so the Lord is telling them, here are these five who made preparation. The others did not make adequate preparation. So we have the wedding, and we have the bridesmaids, and now we have the bridegroom. And as we read, and as we've already stated, at midnight a cry was heard. And behold, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose, trimmed their lamp, and the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, no, lest there should not be enough for us and you, but rather go to those who sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Why does he wait till midnight? Seems like an awkward thing to do. Why doesn't he come when the time is expected? Because that's the point. The point is, you prepare yourself because you don't know when the Lord is going to come. And this man came at an hour which was unexpected. The bridegroom and his party came to bring the bride and her maids back with them. And when he comes, they're all asleep. They're aroused out of their sleep. Those who could trim their lamps. And then they come, and while they go with the wedding party to the bridegroom's house, those who were unprepared went away to buy. And when they come back, the door is shut. It is too late. It's too late. They knock on the door. Let us in, let us in. And notice what follows. Afterward, the other virgins came also saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, assuredly I say to you, I do not know you. I tell you, there are those passages in Scripture that are arresting. They just take your breath away every time you read them. And this is a set of those passages. And while they were gone, the door is shut. All opportunity is closed. All opportunity is lost. And they come and they cried, Lord, open to us. And he said, I don't know. Their fate, because they were unprepared, was the Lord shut the door and said, I don't know you. That's why when you read in this narrative of Matthew chapter 24, Luke chapter 21, and Mark chapter 13, that there are two in the field, and one is taken, and one is left. There are two grinding, and one is taken, and one is left. Why does that happen? Because one is prepared, and the other is not. In Luke chapter 21, in Luke's narrative of this story, there's something else that takes place here that I think cannot be overlooked as you look in the unfolding of the narrative. You have the consideration that he comes down in verse 25 of Luke chapter 21. There will be signs in the sun, in the moon, in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations and perplexities, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear and expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift your heads, because your redemption is near. You have two groups of people that are mentioned here. You have those whose hearts fail them when this opportunity comes, and those who, when the coming of the Son of Man takes place in the form of the Roman army and Titus the Roman general, they cry out, this is the day of redemption that we've been looking for. Josephus will talk about this scene in his writings. He'll talk about how the gates of the city would be opened and closed in the morning and the evening. And they weren't hollow core doors like at the back of this auditorium where a big wind could blow the doors open. There were large, huge, humongous gates that took a multitude of men to close them and to open them. And on this occasion, the gates of the city were opened. And there were those who looked and they saw Titus and the Roman general, the Roman army, coming down upon their city. And their hearts failed them. And there were those at that same scene who saw the Roman armies descending upon the city. And they said, look up, lift up your head, for this is the day of our redemption. This is the day we've been looking for. What was the difference in those two groups of people? Was one group of people just dumber than the other? No. Those who said, look up, lift up your head, the day of redemption is near, those were the wise. Those were the ones who had been preparing. Those were the ones who had been watchful. And those whose hearts failed them. Notice, the magistrates didn't fail them as listed before. Their family didn't fail them as listed before. Now their own hearts failed them. They had not prepared themselves, had not brought enough oil to be prepared. And now then, Back to Matthew chapter 25, the groom comes at an unexpected hour. They go to buy. It's no longer available. Before it was available, now the opportunity is closed, the door is shut. It's no longer available. The Lord said, you can read the signs. Look back in Matthew chapter 24. He says, across the page, beginning in verse 45, who then is wise and foolish servant with whom his master made ruler over his own household to give them food in due season? Blessed the servant when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly I say to you, he'll make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to feed his fellow servant to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on that day when he's not looking of him, and at an hour when he's not aware of him, and will cut him in two and appoint his portion with the hypocrites, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Back to Luke chapter 21 a moment. And read what Luke will say in Luke chapter 21 with regard to this preparing. Here's a servant who ought to be prepared for his master's coming, but he's not. So he says in verse 29 of Luke chapter 21, then he spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are budding and you see, you know for yourselves that summer is now near. So also when you see these things happening, know the kingdom of God is near. And what he says is, when you see a fig tree budding, you know the springtime's coming. Now, I don't know how it is in Wichita, in the Kansas area. I'm just a visitor in Kansas. I'm not native. I know very little about the history of Kansas. But I'll tell you what it's like in Texas. In my front yard, my used-to-be front yard, I had a big Bradford pear. And early on, that dumb thing would start budding. And you think, man, spring's here. And next thing you know, you got an ice storm or you got a heavy frost. You couldn't trust that Bradford prayer to tell you the truth about the weather, straight up or backwards. It didn't know fall from spring. But tell you what, you go out West Texas. You go out, you start about Abilene, about 3 hours due west of Dallas. And you go further West Texas where there are mesquite bushes. There's one thing absolutely all old West Texans know for sure. It's reliable, will not fail, it is true. That Bradford pear may bud when it's not time to bud, but when that old mesquite tree buds, you know the last frost is over. You can read the signs. He says in Luke chapter 21 in the same narrative, that same servant who's unprepared, can you read the signs of the fig tree? And when you read the signs of the fig tree, what do you know? You know the time is near. You know it's about time for this to happen. Well, when you see these signs I'm giving you, this is not the coming of the Son of Man at the end of the age. There's no rapture in this that he's talking about here. What he's saying is, you know the end of this time has come. The fulfillment of what I'm telling you, the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of this temple is now upon you. And here it is. You be prepared, and you be prepared now, because you don't know when that time is going to come. But you can read the signs, and when you can read the signs, it's time for you to make ready your oil. It's time for you to take advantage of the opportunity and grace that's now available to you. All pretense is over. Who we are is really, really revealed at this time. Well, we don't want the fate of the unprepared. There's no one of us that want that ominous feeling of seeing the door shut and crying out to the Lord, Lord, open, and Him saying, I never knew. So what lessons can we learn then from this narrative? I think the first thing that we need to learn is that we need a tenacious faith that looks past the moment. We need a tenacious faith that looks past the moment. There are so many things that happen in our lives that demand our attention. Technology hasn't made our lives simpler. They have made simple tasks multiply. And now we do more than we ever did before because the technology to do it enables us to spend more time doing more. It's easy to get wrapped up in the daily things of life and overwhelmed by the urgency of the moment, that what we lose is we lose the tenaciousness of our faith. And so what he's saying is here, we need something more than just a mindless emotion. We need a faith that is larger than the moment. Have a tenacious faith that is larger than the moment, and don't be swept up with a mindless sense of emotion in the moment. You make the preparations now. The failure was not that they missed the bridegroom. The failure was that they did not properly prepare for the bridegroom. And here's what we are good at as people. It's not just Americans. It's true with people. It's true with me. It's true with you. We make moderate the important and passionate the insignificant. And that's what they had done. They were moderate about that which was urgent and were passionate about that which was insignificant. And what we need inscribed upon us is not just the fact that we have our oil, but that we have His will and His heart inscribed upon us. We are representatives of who He is. We have His heart, His character indelibly impressed upon us. I want to ask you, in this narrative, who are the ones that unfashionably fit? It's the foolish. It's the foolish. It's the wise who stand out. Because those who are foolish, they're unprepared. They fit in with everybody else, but it's the wise who stand out. If you're wise and you are prepared, you stand out from everybody else that is unprepared, because everybody else is walking around unprepared. He says, you go buy the oil. He's not saying here, don't stretch that. Don't stretch that to say, well, what we have to do is we have to be so good that what we're going to do is we're going to work for it and therefore justify our salvation because we worked for it, we've earned it, we bought it. That's not what he's saying at all here. He's saying here, being prepared demands more than an occasional, frightened, stricken response. I'm not trying to scare anybody to death this morning. What I'm trying to get us to see is our faith must be tenacious so that we need more than on one occasion, a faith that is born of a fear that has struck us in this moment. And he says, you go buy your oil. He says, you have to buy your oil. You have to be prepared for that moment. You can't borrow it from somebody else. You can't borrow the tenacious faith from somebody else and therefore have their faith. And parents, let me stop here and make this important point. We're not going to spend all of our children's adolescent lives while they're with us engaging in every mindless thing that is unimportant in this earth and give our full passion to that and then hand them off in their adulthood and expect them to be prepared. It's not going to come in that moment. It's going to come because we moment by moment have been preparing them. It's not going to be because all of a sudden we set them on their own, give them a nice little pat on the bottom and say, go on your way, prepare yourself. It's going to come because we've been preparing them all along. And I'm not trying to spit in anybody's face here. I'm not just trying to slap anybody. I'm not trying to poke anybody in the eye here. But it's real. If we spend our time passionate about mindless things and insignificant things, then we shouldn't be surprised when they're on their own, they're passionate about the same things we prepared them to be passionate about. And mindless about the same things we prepared them to be mindless about. We need to understand the urgency of that. His character must be deeply rooted in our character as well. Our relationship is personal. It cannot be borrowed. And therefore, we can't live with indifference. You know, isn't it just a small thing They didn't have oil. Isn't it just a small thing? And they go and they buy it, and now they come and they knock. They've got it. They come and they knock, and they say, "Now, Lord, open to us." Doesn't that seem like a small, insignificant thing? And it might to us, except the Lord said it wasn't. The Lord said it was a big thing. It was something that really, really mattered. Was it such a bad thing they were late to the wedding? But when the door was shut, the Lord said, "I never knew you," that made it a big thing. And then finally, in our narrative in Matthew chapter 25, He says, verse 13, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." Here's the point of the whole thing. Destruction is coming. The Roman army is coming to be representative of the Son of Man coming, and you be prepared. Now let's apply that to us. 1 Timothy chapter 5 talks about the thief coming in the night when the Lord comes again. If we knew that the Lord was going to come on March 6th, 2016, and I have to use that because that's my birth date and I can get that straight. If we knew the Lord was going to come on March 6th, 2016, what would we do? You don't have to raise your hand. And wives, you don't have to poke your husbands in the side. Husbands, you don't have to kick your wife's ankle. Is anybody here a procrastinator? How many of you work to a deadline? And if the deadline's not there, everything is off limits. I mean, everything's available until the deadline is near. Well, if we knew the deadline was March 6, 2016, what would be our propensity? Well, that's tomorrow. That's tomorrow. And then, okay, March 3rd comes. That's my son's birthday. I can get that right. And now then, March 6th is almost here. We better start thinking about it now. March 4th, we go to bed, and tomorrow we're really going to start preparing, and March 5th comes, and now we put the rush on. That's not what the Lord wants. The Lord wants us to spend our lives being prepared so that even if we knew the date, it wouldn't matter, but not knowing the date makes it all the more relevant for us. Because we don't know when He's going to come. Or we don't know when we're going to breathe our last. He says, "You have your oil and you have your lambs trimmed." Because just like the coming of the Son of Man, the destruction of Jerusalem, you're not going to know. Don't be so busy today, moment by moment, you're living your life, overwhelmed with it, you pay no attention to the Lord, you forget Him, you shut Him aside, you sleep at night, but you don't wake thinking about Him. And you spend a little time giving Him consideration. What He's saying is, "I want to awaken you. You watch." We sing a song sometimes, "Jesus is coming soon." Well, that day is going to be the same day for everybody. And it's not going to be the same day for everybody. Because for some, it's going to be a day that's bitter. And for some, it's going to be a day that's sweet. And we want to be people who make sure the day is sweet. And I want you to understand, this parable is not for people who never have known the Lord. This parable is for people who, having known Him, have it prepared to meet Him. Because you see, in the end, those who externally had all the accoutrements to make them seem to be part of the party where they belonged, though everything externally was there, they were unprepared. May it not be that the most haunting words we ever hear, because the most haunting experience we ever had, was the door shut and the Lord said, "I never knew you." Are you, am I, prepared to meet the Lord? If not, we want to help you while we stand and while we sing.